Okay, let's turn to the deal on Iran. First question. Now that we have drawn the line in the sand with the Iran nuke deal, what should our response be if they break the deal? What were the calculations for potential failures going into the deal?
Well, this will be interesting. I'll respond, and then I'm sure the chairman will have something to say about this. It's very interesting sitting here next to Chairman Rogers, now that he's no longer in Congress and I'm no longer in the administration. It's very nice. We were very nice when we were in our roles, too. Look, this deal is not and never was about trust. There is tremendous mistrust between our countries. We mistrust the Iranians, they mistrust us. The enmity goes back not only to the hostages that were held for so many days in 1979, but all the way back to the 50s when we worked with British intelligence to knock off their prime minister after he nationalized the oil industry and made the British go crazy. So the mistrust is very deep and very profound. The deal was about monitoring and verification. And the monitoring and verification mechanisms that have been put in place are the most extensive that have ever been in place forever. And as I think most people know here, this negotiation began bilaterally in secret, then was brought into the P5 plus one. That's the five members of the permanent members of the Security Council, who happen to be the five members of the nuclear club. That's why they are the five permanent members of the Security Council, plus Germany and the European Union. And it took us 2 years to do this because it is incredibly complicated and because all of the devil is in the details. So I believe that we have an agreement that should ensure that Iran never develops a nuclear weapon because we have cut off all the pathways to fissile material. That's what's needed to create the actual weapon itself, either highly enriched uranium or weapons-grade plutonium, or a covert supply chain to be able to do that, and we've cut them all off. The International Atomic Energy Agency has said that Iran has complied with everything they were supposed to do to get us to lift, not to terminate, but to suspend, in essence, our sanctions and the international sanctions. So far, since January, when we had implementation day, Iran has done what it was supposed to do, and that was a significant reduction in the number of centrifuges, the amount of stockpile they can have, the level of enrichment they can do, access to any site where we have suspicions, including military sites. And all of these things are really quite locked in with all kinds of technology used to know what they're doing. So let's say they cheat. In my view, we have three things. One, we can find out what the hell they were doing. And we had an interim deal, a first step, so we'd have time to negotiate the comprehensive deal. And during that time, some things went wrong. And we went to them, and we found out some errant things had happened by people who were either trying to sabotage the deal or just screwed up. And we got them fixed. So the first step would be diplomatically to, and it's why we put in a 30-day review period when there's disagreement, to see whether whatever the problem is can be fixed. But if it is egregious, if it is significant, if we determine it's significant, even if nobody else does, we can immediately go to the UN Security Council. And the way the vote is taken at the Security Council, we can use our veto to ensure that all of the multilateral sanctions snap back immediately. And we, of course, because we have only suspended the sanctions in the United States, the President of the United States can slap them back on whenever. There is no doubt it will be harder in the sense that lots of countries will have come in and started commercial ventures with Iran. But at the same time, I think countries are cautious because they know that until there's a track record, things can snap back. And then, of course, we can add additional sanctions to what we already have. And then, of course, there is always the military option. And to the point that my colleagues made earlier, part of the reason this diplomacy worked is because there was force in service of diplomacy. The President of the United States had commissioned a weapon that could penetrate the underground nuclear site that Iran had created called Fordo, and had commissioned it, gotten the Congress to help pay for it, had tested it, and had deployed it, and had rearranged our forces in the theater so Iran knew we were serious. So military force is critical to diplomacy. It does set the table, as the chairman said, to be able to try to accomplish diplomacy. So I think we are in a very good position here, but I want everybody to be clear, this has nothing to do with trust.
I might just mention before I ask the others to comment, on the weapon that we had designed to go after Fordo and penetrate, we developed that weapon, as you're right, and we tested it. And as a matter of fact, when Israel was threatening to attack Iran, I sat down with the defense minister and showed him, you know, the fact that we had that weapon. And I think it played a role in convincing them to kind of hold back what had occurred. Mike, your comments on
this is the Jerry Springer moment. Tonight's event. And then before I give you my opinion on it, I do think that Americans can be proud. We did have meetings in classified sessions leading up to all of this. And there were impassioned debates, which I would hope we would all want to happen, because it had to happen in a classified session. You don't want everybody nodding and agreeing on something as serious as the Iran deal, saying, yep, we all ought to just get along, let's do it. There were, I thought, good questions, challenges, impassioned moments. And
I loved every moment.
Almost. Almost every moment you loved. But I will tell you this, you have one of the best, most qualified diplomats to serve in that capacity, who was there and a part of it. Now, I disagreed with the way it came out and some of the details of it, but I do not disagree with the people that we had leading this fight. That's, to me, is the important part about disagreeing on political issues moving forward on national security. You have to have those discussions. There's going to be disagreements, but I certainly, it wasn't the qualifications of the people who were engaged in this, and I compliment
Thank you
for that. Okay, now.
Now that the pleasantries are over.
Yeah, the pleasantries are over.
With all due respect.
Yeah. With all due respect. You know, I mean, I had a lot of concerns about the way it was unraveling. And again, I'm not telling a tale out of school. We've had these discussions, honestly. And by the way, it was never not civil. I think that's very important for people to understand. We just had passionate differences of opinion. And so I'll tell you how I first heard about the first round of negotiations. A foreign nation state contacted me and said, did you know that your government is meeting in a third nation with the Iranians? Now, I'm the chairman of the Intelligence Committee. And I said, excuse me? I had to hang up the phone, as Leon would know how this would work. And those are never pleasant calls to have or to get, I imagine, to get that straightened out. I thought that was poor form. And what it told me is not because it hurt my feelings, that you had foreign nation states who now thought something's going on that makes me very uncomfortable, and why am I not included in it? I thought that was the first, largest, biggest mistake going into these negotiations. And then secondly, guys like me had issues, and by the way, this was bipartisan, it certainly was leading up to the agreement. There were just people who look at this for a long time too, who said, hey, there's some really significant challenges here to get over. One is, if you continue to narrow the field on what is in the negotiations, you will leave open all of these proxy fights that will lead to mistrust for our Arab League partners. And I think it's hard to disagree that some of that certainly led through and causes problems now that we have trying to get them back on other issues. Now, some may argue it was worth that consternation for them. Some would argue it's not. I argue maybe not. And so now you have these countries making decisions, which is all the things we talked about, that I don't think are healthy for the future of the country, including buying nuclear weapons, talking about buying nuclear weapons, talking about creating nuclear programs of their own. Egypt has had the discussion. Jordan signed a deal with, I think, South Koreans on a deal. The Egyptians signed a deal with the Russians. So now you have exactly what people like me were afraid of. You've created this this whole monster. I'm not sure how we get back in. And I wasn't sure exactly the deal did exactly what we needed. And my argument with the snapback provisions is why I don't think it is. There's a provision in the agreement that says if you do a contract that's not related to the nuclear program, that contract has to be fulfilled. Now, it may be a day and a half in the contract, it could be 2 years of the contract, which is exactly why Boeing just announced that they're interested in doing a deal with Iran. Trust me, they're not going to go into Iran and do a deal on airplanes if there isn't some fulfillment of that contract. There's no way they're going to do that.
That's actually not accurate.
No, it is accurate. This is how we got into this person. And this was the big fight publicly, that it wasn't accurate. The language is very clear in the bill. And so how I think it got misinterpreted was because it had to be related to the nuclear program. Well, the problem is there are lots of contracts not related to the nuclear program. Matter of fact, the Germans, you couldn't buy a plane ticket when this deal got signed between Berlin and Tehran. And most of it was filled, I'm a Michigan guy, we know these things, and an intelligence guy, about auto parts. Boy, they could, and God bless them, right? I'm for a free and open market. But it was all about to try to get those contracts done as fast as they could. The gold rush was on, and none of that was factored in, that $150 billion, some people said $50 billion, some people said $80 billion. None of this was factored in the economic growth of Iran. Yeah, but this is my point. The administration would say $50 billion, but hear me out. You had your turn. This is that fight we had in the chamber.
I got a few other issues.
I know, but this is important.
And I got to make correct.
This is important.
All right, make the points.
That economic growth beyond that $50 billion is nearly impossible to put back. Now they have cash in which to operate in Yemen, and this is what our Arab League partners tell us. So it's not that any day that you can stop nuclear anything is a good day. And there are some good things and good provisions in the bill. I thought when you took the total weight of what they didn't get versus what they did get, including the notion that they just tested missile systems, which are incredibly dangerous, and we don't really have a way to look at. We have no real leverage on the missile systems part right now. I argued if you take the whole weight of it, wasn't the right decision for us at this time. So I think it's an honest disagreement. I think folks will fall on both sides.
You get 30 seconds.
Right, I'm not going to go into all the disagreements, including on the missiles piece, but just for any Boeing out there or anyone else who wants to do business within the very small limits the U.S. has, because the U.S. still has a primary embargo, unlike our European partners, if Boeing does a contract and an entity with which it does the contract is redesignated when we snap back the sanctions, they have to pull out of the contract. They have to leave, and they have to unwind it. So that is just sine qua non.
If we debate this, that tells you there's a flaw in the agreement.
Our lawyers won't debate it at all.
And our lawyer said the other side. That's why you have two sets of lawyers.
Let me move on. Ray, you want to comment?
If I could just make a quick comment.
You want to get in this, too?
No.
Welcome.
I want to make another point, actually. First, I would say the Joint Chiefs really were not involved in the details of the agreement, which we have no issue with. But what I would say was a couple things. Is one, we view it as any nation without a nuclear weapon is a positive thing, and especially since a nation such as Iran with a nuclear weapon becomes very dangerous because their calculation to use it could be very different than a nation such as Russia, China, the United States. The second point I'd make and the last point I'd make is we should not confuse this with any freezing of hostilities between Iran and the United States. Iran continues to do an incredible amount of nefarious things around the world, and this does not mean we are now best friends with Iran. This is just one small piece, an important piece, of trying to help them from gaining a nuclear weapon, and we should not forget all the other things that they are involved with, which is direct action in some cases against U.S. entities around the world.
Let's deal with the other rogue state right now, North Korea. This is a question on Kim Jong-un, which is making threats, and it seems like no one is taking him seriously. But what if he does do something? Is the American government ready for such an attack?
Well, I would say this. My fear is the unstable nature of Kim Jong-un. Nobody really knows who he is. And I worry that his actions and chances of miscalculation grow by the minute. We've heard threats from North Korea before, but not like these and not from this individual. So obviously there's great concern that he could do something that could quickly escalate into something that nobody wants. And you know, if he develops a tactical nuclear weapon or even a regional nuclear weapon, and again, this applies to him double than it probably does to Iran, the potential for him to use that is probably much greater than the rest of these nations. And so if that happens, the potential for chaos will escalate quite quickly. I just remind everybody that within South Korea, there are probably hundreds of thousands of Americans, some military, some civilian, and the American population would be very much affected if it was used against South Korea. And then you have this potential to create this level of instability in a region that's very important economically to all of us. So it's really important that we try to keep this issue from escalating. And so it's important that we work with China to ensure this does not escalate beyond what we think it should. And you know, I worry because, and there might be a difference of opinion, China used to have more control, I believe, over North Korea than they do now. Doesn't mean they don't have control. They have economic levers. But I worry that they don't have the control they once had. So I just think we have to take these threats seriously, because if we don't, it could cause chaos. And so it's important for us that if they launch an invasion, it's too late. So we've got to, you know, what we have to do is deter them. We have to make sure they understand that if they do something, it's going to cost them. And it's got to be more than just the U.S. Trying to deter them from making a huge miscalculation.
Okay, let's turn to another interesting player in the world, Russia. Putin's Russia has been much more aggressive of late in annexing Crimea and in continuing disruption in the Ukraine. In addition, they deployed forces, as we know, to Syria. How does the United States draw the line on Putin?
He made a really interesting calculation about, I'm going to guess, 8-9 years ago. He made a really interesting foreign policy speech where he outlined a lot of the things he wanted to accomplish in his foreign policy objectives. One was to make sure the country of Georgia, did not get into NATO. The second was Ukraine didn't get into NATO, that he reasserted some influence in former Soviet bloc countries, that he reasserted himself on the national stage, and he did that by plopping in some really sophisticated nuclear submarines that give us all pause. And the last was he was going to push back on missile defense for the United States. If you know, sometimes we always say that the Russians look like us, but they don't think like us. And so sometimes I think we misinterpret where they're going with this. And if you look at what he could say to his parliament today is that they occupy 20% of the country of Georgia today, and they have refortified militarily. They're sending some of their best new equipment to fortify that 20%, South Ossetia being one of it. They fundamentally changed the battlefield by using cyber as a preparation of the battlefield in a way we hadn't really seen before 2008. That now fundamentally changes the way we look at cyber in our national defense and security posture, including how we use it in an offensive capacity. Ukraine, I think Crimea was, just a treat. I don't think he really planned on Crimea. The way it unfolded, I think, was an opportunity for him. There were missile engine plants along that eastern border area of Ukraine and Russia that produced all of their engines for their ICBMs. Guess where those are today, right? Those are back firmly under control of Vladimir Putin. I don't even think he wants Ukraine. I mean, maybe you have a difference of opinion. I really don't. I think he just wants to disrupt it enough that it isn't going to NATO. So they've announced that Georgia's not coming into NATO. They've announced that there's been no official announcement, but Ukraine is not even close to meeting the minimum standards now to get into NATO. He looks at this as, I'm winning, and now I'm a big player in Syria, I'm winning, right? I mean, his economy has fallen apart, as you said, very, very happily. But he thinks he's winning, and his population is going through the roof. And he's having a lot of fun. He's re-engaging. He just did a Russian bomber down the English Channel. They turned off all of their transponders and flew it down the English Channel, caused, as you can imagine, all kinds of hectic chaos. He ran a bomber down the west coast of California. We hadn't seen this kind of behavior since really the late 80s. This aggressive. They've been doing huge operations in the Arctic, and I thought this was interesting. This tells me a lot about Putin. We announced in July that we were going to talk about cutting 40,000 Army troops from our service ranks. About 3 months later, he announces he's going to do an exercise with 40,000 troops in the Arctic. Right? I'm sure it may have been a coincidence. I don't know. I'm an FBI guy. I'm not sure I buy it. He's very clever, and he was sending a clear message. And by the way, he did do this huge operation in the Arctic, and he's trying to lay claim into the Arctic.
So I think this is
his time.
So how do we send a signal to Putin that he can't just do anything he wants in the world?
So I think his moves are a bit more calculated. If you read his speeches from 4 or 5, maybe 6, 7 years ago, he says that the Cold War ended in the wrong way and that he has to regain some of the losses that the Russia suffered under in the Cold War, Soviet Union. And what he's talking about, then he'll say that the U.S. and EU did not keep their promises economically to the Russian people, and that's why the Russian economy is failing. He then said they promised they wouldn't move into Eastern European countries. They've now become part of NATO. We've got to regain the protection of countries around Russia in order to assert Russian influence and our proud heritage. And he's built a nationalist fervor that has allowed him now to make some moves. Georgia, Ukraine. So what I worry is the next move is that he's going to challenge a small NATO country. Because I believe what he would really like to do is potentially attack NATO and let NATO disintegrate in front of his eyes. And the way to do that is you go into Latvia, Lithuania, pick your small country, and NATO, which is supposed to, under Article 5, respond, does not respond. And then NATO falls apart. So whether he's going to do this or not, I can't tell you. But I believe running a bomber down the English Channel, running a bomber off the coast, he's testing to see what reactions he gets from the United States and from NATO. So I believe in order to stop him, we need, you know, and oh, by the way, why this is all going on, we are significantly decreasing our presence in Europe. NATO has stopped over the last 10 years investing in their military in Europe. So the response needs to be a reinvestment in capability in Europe. We are rotating more, the U.S. Army and Air Force is rotating more forces into Europe, but I think there's more that has to be done slowly over time to reassert our position in Europe and that we will, in fact, not allow him to go into a NATO country. We have to continue to encourage forcefully investment by our NATO allies in defense. The agreement is you're supposed to put 2% of your GDP in defense. And as far as we know, France is meeting it, and now the UK maybe is meeting it.
And Poland,
yeah. And that's it. And so we've got to reassert, we lead NATO, we have to reassert ourselves, and we have to make sure that we continue to put pressure on him so he does not overreach, which could cause a significant issue inside of Europe. And so, you know, some of the European, I believe some of the Europeans are hesitating because he does control gas that goes into Europe, natural gas. And so some countries are hesitant to act, and we have to just work our way through that. And so this, I believe, is important. And I think now that his leadership, that they will say, and I don't agree with it, he is showing now in the Middle East, is now adding to this idea that Russia is once again growing, and so I worry about that. And I'll just make one comment that they did surprise us with their military operations inside of the Ukraine. How quickly they were able to move, how sophisticated they were in managing cyber integrated with conventional operations. They've done it in a way that we had not seen anyone else do. And so they have been investing in this. They've been retraining their military. And so all I'm saying is there's great caution that has to be taken, and we have to take this very seriously.
Wendy, let's take the same approach now, looking at China and what China's doing in the South China Sea. They've now, I mean, obviously we knew they had asserted sovereignty over the South China Sea. They've now built these islands. They are militarizing these islands with missiles and fighter planes, et cetera, and basically, you know, militarizing the South China Sea. What do we do to check them in terms of...
They are militarizing the South China Sea. They're also trying to create economic supremacy in the South China Sea. They long ago set out a doctrine called the 9.9 line, which basically created economic zones around all of these islands and all of these pieces of territory that they are now claiming is there so that they control commerce. And it's the control of commerce that is really fundamentally what is here. Absolutely, we're concerned about the military bases doing airstrips, their ability to project power in those ways and to have those different outlets. But this is fundamentally also an economic strategy on China's part to control commerce. We can't allow that to happen. Most of the commerce of the larger share of the commerce of the world goes through the South China Sea. So we can't allow that to occur. We have worked hard to try to get a code of conduct among the South Asian nations about how you should interpret the law of the sea and what is possible. We have to stare them down when they do things that they should not, and I thought it was great that we sent some of our fine military to just hover over an island to say, you know, we're watching, we see, we're not going to stand back, we're going to do what we need to do, we'll take action when we need to take action. We've told countries that we don't get in the middle of territorial disputes, but at the same time, we have to call out China and we have to take action. I think in both of these instances, China, which is trying to test our leadership, and Russia is most certainly trying to test our leadership, and I associate myself strongly with both my colleagues, but particularly what General Odierno said about what Putin is testing here, where NATO is concerned and our forces in Europe and our missile defense capabilities in Europe. The United States has to use our military tactically as well as strategically in these situations to not draw lines in the way of, you know, we're going to start a war if you do this, but rather to say, we see what you're doing, we're going to call you out for what you're doing. We are going to work with other countries in the region to make sure that we all take the actions that are necessary to make sure that there's freedom of navigation in the seas. Critical.
Mike, question from the audience. What actions would the United States take in the case of a massive cyber attack?
Well, the question is, I don't think we really know. And so here's the, well, and that's part of the problem, right? The policy has been muddled. We are the only nation, about 85% of our networks in America are private sector networks. Contrary to popular belief, they're not monitored by the NSA. You snicker because you think that is or not. The conspiracy theorists, please see me outdoor right. This is a huge problem for us, because if we even decide that we're going to respond, we're going to go and flick somebody in the forehead with cyber capability. And by the way, this is not a capability problem. That is the least of our problems. It's that if we do that, they're not going to come back at the Defense Department or NSA or the CIA. They're going to go find some company somewhere that is minding their own business in the United States that is highly integrated and take them off the grid. And we've seen that with North Korea in Sony. That was a nation state attacked an American company. And if you think about it, what could we do? How did we respond to that? Iran attacked a great American company, the Sands Resort Casino. I'm sure you've left some money there, some of you, at least this section over here, I've seen you there. You think about that, they took their time. It was absolutely to punish the CEO for a political position he took in the continental United States. And according to public reports, was able to get about $40 million worth of damage to his company in a weekend. A nation state attacked an American company. I don't know if there's other examples of this. We've watched Russia go into Germany and go after these big blaster steel making plants that and turn down, they're called SCADA systems, turn them off so that they couldn't control the heat of these blasters, which is really dangerous stuff. Very dangerous. We just watched Russia attack, use its cyber, its nation-state cyber attack in Ukraine to shut down the electric grid. Now, the interesting thing about Ukraine is they're not nearly as well connected. They were able to shut off the power. They got their power up in about 2 days because they went and, like an old lawnmower and pulled them started again, right? They just went and sent people to the substations and turned them back on. They weren't connected to the internet. We looked at that and said, you know what, Houston, we have a problem. If they did the same thing to us, you wouldn't have power for a month, 45 days, 6 months. And so here's the problem with the massive cyber attack. It will probably take that to wake up Congress and the American people as to what the threats are. But I'm not sure, at the response time, we don't have a good kind of threat matrix, and then how we respond in kind matrix on a scale of, you know, do you send a missile for a cyber attack? Do you do a cyber attack for a cyber attack? Do you maneuver? I mean, what is our diplomatic options? They're not great when it comes to cyber, and we really haven't figured it out as a nation, which is really should scare the hell out of all of you.
Can I just add one point to this?
Drink carts. Yeah. This
just
is one of drink carts.
One point to this. We do have capabilities. We do have capabilities, because I think people need to know the other side of this story. We do have capabilities to counter some of the cyber warfare, and we also have to be very, very thoughtful about our offensive capabilities, because if you start a cyber war, it can easily go out of control. And I'll use something that was in the New York Times without affirming it, and that was Stuxnet, which was used by someone in Iran, which had an impact, but also got into the malware system beyond Iran. So this is a very complicated, very difficult. The chairman has done an enormous amount of work on this, as has General Odierno, because you can't be in the military without beginning to think about cyber command. And needless to say, the Secretary of Defense has been very engaged in this. As I said, staggering hours have been spent in the Situation Room trying to think through all of these eventualities. It is very tough. We are good at what we do. We are very good at what we do. But this keeps on growing in everybody's capacity. And so staying ahead of it is very tough.
If I could just make one point. If I was a citizen, I am. But if I was you as well.
I am a citizen. Is there something you'd like to tell us?
Tell us.
The general was born in Canada.
I'm so used to wearing a uniform. I consider ourselves not. I don't know if I don't consider ourselves citizens or what.
You
should demand better public-private partnership on cyber and sharing of information and sharing of capabilities. That's the problem we have now, and we need legislation and other things that will help us to a much better effort in protecting our infrastructure through private-public partnerships. And I think the military is more than willing and ready to help and provide capabilities and share information, but it's important that we start thinking about this and writing the laws necessary for us to do this to protect our infrastructure. Because I agree with, this is one of the major, the most complex and likely threats that we face. And what's even scarier to me is it's not expensive to develop it. So I worry about ISIS and Al-Qaeda and everybody else developing a capability that could have significant impacts.
And I just want to say this.
Wait a minute.
It's not because there is incompetence in dealing with it. The problem is so complex. Because we are so connected to the internet like no other nation on the face of the earth. That's the problem.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you can see, we could have gone on for another 3 hours talking about these issues. The whole purpose of this is to give you a feel for the challenges that are out there. We're hearing a lot during the campaign about what presidents want to do. Some of it's sane, some of it's insane. But the reality is that it is the people of this country that will really, in the end, determine whether we are an America in renaissance or an America in decline. That's the purpose of what this lecture series is all about. I thank you very much for coming this evening.